I'm Chris Boyd, and this is Think Again, our chance to revisit some of my favorite conversations of the week. On this week's show, what our history with animals can teach us about interacting with robots, and how the hottest dogs on Instagram might not be doing so hot when it comes to their health. If you own a pet, you know how all-consuming it can be being a pet parent. Just like humans, our pets have their own personalities, likes, dislikes, and voices. We do whatever we can to make sure our pets are comfortable and happy and loved. Now, stay with me because we're about to get a little bit theoretical here. What if our relationships with our pets can help guide our relationships with robots?
Danger, Will Robinson! Danger! No, Will Robinson! Danger!
It will be several days before I can function at maximum capacity.
Daily interaction with robots sounds like science fiction, but we're kind of already there. We've brought Roombas into our houses. We ask our Amazon Echoes and Google Homes to complete tasks for us or help solve that question we just don't know the answer to. They might not be our pets, but they're definitely becoming part of our daily lives. And with advancements, they will likely seem more alive in the future.
I keep an eye.
Wally! Coming, sir. Here I am, sir. Yes, sir.
Kate Darling is a researcher in MIT's Technology Media Lab who is studying how our relationships with animals can serve as a blueprint for interacting with robots. She joined me this week to have a weird and wonderful conversation about her book, The New Breed, What Our History with Animals Reveals About Our Future with Robots.
I think that it makes a lot of sense that we focus a lot on humanoid robots because we've always had this fascination with recreating ourselves. And so if you do a Google image search for the term robot, you get a lot of humanoid figures. Like you said, in science fiction, there's a lot of humanoid robots. But I actually think that it really prompts people to compare artificial intelligence to human intelligence and the skills of robots to human skills, when really these technologies are quite different and have quite different skill sets than people do. So I think that it's limiting both from a technical perspective, but it's also limiting in terms of the conversations we're having about how to build robots and integrate them. I think that animals are a much better analogy because in the animal world, we have such a broad diversity of shapes and forms and skills and senses that we've been able to make use of in the past. And we've partnered with animals not because they do what we do, but because they do something that's different and supplemental and useful to us. And so when we think about robots and artificial intelligence, rather than thinking of them as quasi-humans, I'm hoping that we can start thinking of them as a partner in what we're trying to achieve.
For purposes of this discussion, what actually counts as a robot?
That's a great question. There is actually no good universal definition of robot. People from different fields will give different definitions. You find different definitions in dictionaries. If you ask roboticists what a robot is, they'll often say something like, oh, it's a machine that has physical embodiment that can sense its environment in some way, think about the data that it's collecting and make a decision autonomously and then act on its environment. But even that is not a perfect definition when you drill down on it. I mean, is a smartphone a robot because it can vibrate and make light? That's acting on its environment, but a lot of roboticists wouldn't call that a robot either. So basically, robot has always been kind of whatever is in our imagination. And that's actually quite a problem because, like we just talked about, we often envision a quasi-human as a robot instead of thinking more creatively about what this technology could be.
So you propose we use animals as a model for incorporating robots into our lives. We've been doing this for a long time, haven't we?
We have. I mean, thousands and thousands of years, right? We've used oxen to plow our fields. We've used horses to let us travel the earth in new ways. We've used carrier pigeons to carry mail. We've had the Soviet and U.S. navies in the 60s and 70s developing marine mammal training programs where they were training dolphins to detect lost underwater equipment and detect mines, which is something that we're also starting to use robots for now. So there are so many parallels and so many different ways that we've used animals in the past. Although I have to say, what the book tries to do is not say, oh, robots and animals are the same and we should be treating them and using them exactly the same, because obviously there are a lot of differences between robots and animals. You can't dictate an email to a robot. An animal is much better at not falling over than most robots currently. But what I'm trying to do is use a different analogy so that we can just open our minds to more possibilities than just the human one.
So the point with animals is that not that they can do things exactly like we can, but because they have different abilities, right?
Correct. They have physical abilities that extend our own. They have sensing abilities that we've made use of. I mean, you think about a dog's sense of smell and how we've incorporated that and made use of it because it's something that we can't do.
As we learn to train horses and oxen to pull plows and wagons because those jobs are really taxing for human bodies, we also have started sending robots to do things that we find exhausting or boring or dangerous. Can you talk about some of those functions?
Yeah, I mean, it's always been kind of the traditional use case for robots in robotics has been anything that's dirty, dull, or dangerous. So things that we don't actually want humans doing, whether that's a bomb disposal robot that allows soldiers to stay out of harm's way, whether that's space exploration robots, you know, the robots that we've sent to Mars, because that's not actually somewhere that we can go yet. And so I think that those are still great use cases for robots. But beyond that, I want us to be thinking about things that we can't do in the first place at all. So like the ways that we used birds to deliver medicine in the early 1900s and the way that we're using drones for that as well. I mean, that's something that we just aren't able to, we can't fly through the air in the same way that a pigeon can. So I think that any use case that does something that we wouldn't be able to do on our own is really, really a great use case for robots.
So, you know, controversially, at times we have given animals dangerous jobs. Will robots start to take the risk away from animals? For those of us who care about animal welfare, could the rise of robots be good for them?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, we have not treated the animals that we have worked with particularly well in many cases. And, you know, whether that's the dolphins that are gradually being replaced by underwater robots, or whether that's in nursing homes, the robots that are currently being tested as animal therapy replacements in contexts where having real animals is difficult for safety and hygienic concerns, but also for animal welfare concerns, it might actually make sense to replace animals with robots to the extent that we can. Part of why the book is called The New Breed is because, again, robots and animals aren't the same thing. So what robots provide is something new, a new tool that we can add to our toolkit. And so it's not always, you know, a good one-to-one replacement for an animal either.
Nobody really worries that somebody who adopts a puppy or a kitten will never want human friends again. In fact, I think if we know a lonely person, we're usually happy if we hear that they have a pet for company. Why do you think we have so much anxiety that lonely people will stop seeking human interaction if they have access to some kind of robot companion?
Well, I think it is, again, this constant comparison of robots to humans that we do subconsciously. So we're concerned, we automatically assume that a robot that engages people on a social level is intended to or is going to replace their social contact or their friends. We worry about this with children. We worry about this with adults who get robots. And it just strikes me as odd given that we had, you know, in the 60s, there were some people who expressed concern about pets as well. As dogs started becoming more part of the household and part of the family, some psychologists said, oh, you know, this could be, you know, people could focus a little bit too much on, you know, this relationship that they have with their dog, and that might take away from their human relationships. But we have long lost that fear because we realize that animals are very supplemental and, like you said, might even, you know, enhance people's lives, make them less lonely, but without taking away the opportunity for them to connect with other people. And I think that, you know, It depends a little bit on how we design the robots, but I don't see robots taking over human friendships anytime soon. I mean, they're not even interesting enough to do that. I see them very much in a role of a pet or something entirely new. And humans are capable of so many different types of relationships, even amongst other humans, that I think we're just going to fold robots into that without even blinking an eye.
Kate Darling's book is called The New Breed: What Our History with Animals Reveals About Our Future with Robots. Since we're already talking about pets and animals, I have to bring up another conversation I had this week all about dogs.
15 puppies! How marvelous! How marvelous! How perfectly! Oh, the devil take it, they're mongrels.
But it wasn't a conversation all about dogs. It was actually a specific type, designer breeds. So golden doodles, French bulldogs, corgis, Pomeranians, you know. These dogs are bred for aesthetics rather than purpose, and that might not be such a good thing.
It takes a lot of time and research to come across some of these negative impacts that our aesthetic choices have on these animals who we love and really do want to be healthy and happy.
Journalist Tova K. Danovich, who you've heard on Think Before, joined me once again to talk this time about one of her latest articles, The Very Cute, Totally Disturbing Tale of the American It Dog.
A lot of things are appealing about the Frenchie. Some of it, of course, is how they are marketed. If you go onto the American Kennel Club website, which they essentially control the registrations of dogs to say they are purebred of X breed or not. So when you go there, they're described as, you know, a very cute, very adaptable, family-friendly dog, which essentially is what everyone is looking for in a dog. Beyond that, though, their looks are really interesting. Most dogs, you know, have the long, wolfy nose, but French bulldogs, like a lot of other brachiocephalic breeds, have a squished face. And that squished face mimics human faces a lot more closely. They also are known for making a lot of funny sounds. You can find just endless YouTube videos of French bulldogs, you know, complaining about something in a way that sounds much more human than, you know, the woofs and barks that we are used to.
So are we narcissistic in our selection of French bulldogs?
A little bit. And it certainly helps that they're, you know, very Instagram friendly with, you know, the big expressive faces. It's easy to put them in a situation where we can kind of anthropomorphize them and, you know, their desire to perhaps go out to the latest trendy cafe with us.
I have a mutt, so I don't ever really meet people who have the same kind of dog, but it's happened once or twice, and then it's super exciting. I would imagine if you have the kind of dog that is popular and you run into someone else with the same kind of dog, it feels kind of special.
Yeah, I mean, in the same way that for whatever reason, when you pass someone driving the exact same car as you, you always do that little nod. We, you know, we gravitate towards people who have some kind of similarity to us, however small that might be. I have blonde hair, and I found myself in my teen years, you know, gravitating toward the one other person with blonde hair in the room who felt more comfortable to talk to, because at least we had one very visible thing in common to start from, as arbitrary as it might be.
So French bulldogs are unquestionably adorable, but that comes with some downsides. What are the kinds of health problems that French bulldogs are susceptible to?
Yeah, so like other flat-faced dogs, they are extremely prone to breathing difficulties because essentially their soft palate is severely shortened. You know, there's a reason that dogs have long noses, and part of it is that panting cools them off. So they need those tongues, that amount of space in order to do that. So they have trouble breathing. They can have sleep apnea type, you know, things much like humans might, which can be problematic. Exercise is difficult for them because they can't catch their breath. And they're also really prone to overheating because they can't cool themselves. In addition to that, they can have eye problems because their eyes protrude so much and are so wide. They can have skin issues from the wrinkles. Even the shape of their bodies and that kind of small waist that French bulldogs have in some cases leads to a really painful spinal deformity that, you know, can be corrected with expensive surgery, but it's not very fun for the dogs or the owners.
The mothers of these litters sometimes need C-sections to give birth?
It's very common. One of the things that people love about Frenchies are those really big heads on the tiny bodies. And French bulldog moms have really tiny waists. So it's super common for them to be born by C-section, which is one of the reasons, in addition to just their immense popularity, why it's very easy to find a French bulldog for upwards of $5,000.
So how did breed characteristics become set so that a puppy born with the wrong look is considered inferior? Like, who started judging according to those rules?
I mean, essentially, it was just whoever was interested in it. So, you know, you would have a group of fanciers who would create a dog that was just whatever they fancied at the time. And they would, you know, maybe get a couple of other people involved who also wanted to breed dogs that looked that way as a hobby. Because this was, you know, pre any kind of animal welfare legislation, puppies born that didn't have the right look were frequently just killed pretty unceremoniously. And that kind of dovetailed into making the genetic pool for looks small enough that now things tend to breed pretty true to type. But it's all kind of arbitrary.
But certain ideal physical characteristics from a human perspective or from a breed perspective can be a disadvantage for life as a dog, right? So if you crop the ears and dock the tails, even let a dog grow excessively fluffy, it goes to the dog park and all the signals that dogs use to communicate with each other, they may not work properly.
Yeah, that's definitely true. And, you know, it's difficult because dogs, so many of us love them. They're part of our families, and yet they are a commodity, and we are buying them primarily based on liking the way that they look. And I think a lot of people, particularly who buy a lot of dogs, like the flat face breeds, are actually much more commonly purchased by first-time dog owners, is a huge part of their market. And I think it's people really, they see other people with these dogs, and they're cute, and people like their dogs. And, you know, it takes a lot of time and research to come across some of these negative impacts that our aesthetic choices have on these animals who we love and really do want to be healthy and happy.
So, Tova, we've talked about pure breeds. There's also this burgeoning market now for animals that are like crossbred to be their own specialty. So what is the story of the Labradoodle?
Yeah, the Labradoodles are very popular these days. Essentially, in 1989, there was a man who worked with the, I believe it was like a Guide Dogs for the Blind, but in Australia. And he heard from a woman who was blind, but her husband was allergic to the typical labs that you see all the time as guide dogs. And she was wondering if there was any way that he could breed a hypoallergenic dog that would, you know, work for both of them. So he tried a lot of different times to breed poodles, which famously don't shed in quite the same way as other dogs, with labs to create what we now know as the Labradoodle. However, of the initial litter that he had to allergy test the dander on each of the dogs against the woman's husband. And he was only not reactive to one of those dogs. So they became hugely popular for this, you know, marketing gimmick that they were the dog for people who have allergies. And yet it's actually pretty difficult to say that a dog definitely won't bother someone's allergies based on just the two breeds that it came from. You really have to allergy test in order to know that. And yet this was kind of the beginning of this idea that, wow, you can breed a dog to have these specific features that I like. Let's go do more of that. So Labradoodles became really popular when Game of Thrones came out. There was this project to kind of recreate the prehistoric dire wolf by essentially just breeding a lot of dogs together until you get something that looks a little bit like that. So there are a lot of these kind of side projects, and essentially they're just mutts to some extent until they get bred a lot, you know, many times over. But, you know, it's a lot easier to sell a dog for a lot of money if you call it a Frenchie Doodle than here's a rescue dog that's a mix of some random things and I got it in an animal shelter.
Tova K. Danovich's article is called The Very Cute, Totally Disturbing Tale of the American It Dog, and it was published by Fox. Think is a production of KERA in Dallas. Our team includes Stephen Becker, Paige Phelps, Anna Perez, Nilofer Arsala, and Micaela Rodriguez. Our interns are Madison Hurd, Sriya Reddy, and Rolando Hernandez. You can listen to Think wherever you get your podcasts. As always, I'm Chris Boyd. Have a great day.